Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Welcome to Season 5, Episode 23. It is our second physical media episode of Watch with Jen this year. Today's only has two guests. You'll hear me speaking with my friends Blake Howard and Sean Byrne. Sean covers two movies, Blake covers one, but I had a whole stack of films to get through, and this kind of harks back to the first season of the podcast. The show sort of began with me recommending movies solo, talking about them. I was actually recording the podcast on my phone during the pandemic. It was extremely DIY. And then the show evolved as I worked in conversations. I kind of had two dueling podcasts going on. Longtime listeners might remember I called those episodes Watch with Jen and Friends, and sort of jokingly said it was the acoustic version of the show, as opposed to the more polished, prepared episodes that I was doing of Film Recs. This is very casual, but you are going to hear me speaking on my own about a whole stack of movies that I've received since we recorded the last episode on physical media in spring. So without further ado, I will dive into this pile of movies and hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much. Okay, let's fight. A little bit of girl fighting with two movies directed by women with fight in the title, released by Criterion, that are gorgeous additions. I'm talking about Dogfight from 1991 and Girl Fight, which was released in 2000. If you're a longtime listener, you know that Dogfight is a film I'm very passionate about. If you haven't heard the episode, I do urge you to seek it out. This conversation that I had earlier this season with my good friend, Kate Hagen, who was a guest co-host for the episode where we spoke with director Nancy Savoca and her husband, producer Richard Gay, about all of their films, essentially. But we also talked, of course, about Dogfight because it was getting the Criterion Edition release around that time. So they had more to say about it in that episode. I don't want to repeat myself, but I will tell you that this is a beautiful film. It takes place in the late 60s. River Phoenix is an 18-year-old Marine getting ready to go to Vietnam. He arrives in town from this hyper-masculine Marine setting where they have decided that they're going to throw what they call a dogfight, which is man who brings the ugliest date to this thing wins, which is a really cruel idea. And it kind of brings up questions of machismo and groupthink and, you know, trying to prove themselves and do things that they might not believe in, but they're pushed because of peer pressure, essentially. And he meets Lily Taylor, who is just adorable. She's a waitress. She wants to be a folk singer. And she's very optimistic, very open-hearted. And he invites her out for the evening. She has no idea that this is the party they're going to. This sounds like the worst movie ever as I'm describing it right now, but it turns into a very tender love story between these two people as they, you know, question what the hell they were doing, especially him when she figures out what's going on. And it's, yeah, it is a surprisingly moving film. I think when I first heard about it, I was just, you know, horrified. But I can't tell you how wonderful it winds up being. The soundtrack, of course, because it is the late 60s and we are talking about this folk music era. You're going to hear everyone from Joan Baez to Bob Dylan to Pete Seeger. And there's a really great usage of Van Morrison's TV Sheets that I actually talked to Nancy Savoca about in that episode I mentioned before. So do look it up. There are new interviews done for this release. There's audio commentary. Filmmaker Mary Herron talks to Lily Taylor and Savoca. That's on here. There were a bunch of Savoca pictures that were getting some releases, and this is kind of the creme de la creme, the Criterion Collection edition. So I can't recommend Dogfight enough. Girl Fight came out of Sundance in 2000, which was one of the best Sundance years, you guys. If you're unfamiliar, 2000 Sundance also had films such as Two Family House, which is another picture I love so much. You Can Count on Me, one of my absolute favorites. Had Dow of Steve, Saving Grace, The Ballad of Ramblin' Jack, Songcatcher, Committed, Paragraph 175. It was just a phenomenal year at Sundance. And we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of all of these films. So what a great time to release Karan Kusama's Girl Fight. This was the debut film from Karan Kusama, who would go on to make films like Jennifer's Body and Destroyer, and a film that I think everyone should see called The Invitation, which is the scariest goddamn movie. It starts out and you're in like the canyons of LA and you don't know what you're watching. These people are driving to a dinner party. They don't want to go. It's like at one of their exes. You're not sure what's happening. And it turns slowly into the most uncomfortable, surprising, frightening thing you've ever seen. It was one of those movies that I saw and then immediately like called everyone I knew and was like, you need to watch The Invitation. So that is also director Karan Kusama. But back to Girl Fight. This film launched Michelle Rodriguez, of course, you know, member of the family, the Fast and Furious family, Michelle Rodriguez, who is a unique, one-of-a-kind presence, my goodness. And Karan Kusama was taking boxing lessons and got into it. And from that, she wrote the script for Girl Fight and decided to make it. And luckily, John Sayles and Maggie Renzi were two of the champions that came to her aid, helped get this film made. They're always, you know, doing that, especially for really unique voices and female filmmakers. Sayles and Renzi were also instrumental with Savoca and Gay, so there's an overlap there. Besides the fact that these are two movies with fight in the title, I'm not just being cute, you guys, there is a link. These are moving, character-driven stories, and in this film, Diana Guzman, played by Michelle Rodriguez, is bullied at home. She doesn't have a good home life. She finds unexpected refuge in Brooklyn, learning to box. She starts trying to channel her rage and her strength and figure out what she wants. She meets somebody that she falls in love with. A lot happens. I will admit that it kind of does hit a couple of plot points that are a little predictable as it goes on, especially in the overlap of the romance with the storyline. It does kind of, I don't know if I'd want to say suspend disbelief, but it does kind of go where you expect it to. And I will say that that detracts from the film slightly. But overall, Girl Fight is just a great picture. You can see why Michelle Rodriguez actually did receive accolades at Sundance when this film was released. It tied with You Can Count on Me for the Grand Jury Prize. And Kusama also won the Best Director Award. I remember Janet Maslin, who was actually on the jury that year at Sundance, replying to me about You Can Count on Me, which was one of my favorites. And she said that the reason that that didn't win solo is because they just couldn't figure out which film they want. They wanted to make sure that they honored them both. They were all spoiled that year with so many good performances and pictures. So 2000 Sundance, look it up, watch all those films that I mentioned, and I'm sure I'm missing some. Those are just like the award winners, essentially, and there are other award winners that I forgot to mention, I know. But Girl Fight and Dog Fight, these are beautiful Criterion releases. And I think that they would make great additions, especially if you are interested in female filmmakers and American filmmaking, independent filmmaking. Girl Fight and Dog Fight are wonderful. And next up, we have my good friend, Sean Burns, the critic from WVUR. Sean, how are you doing?
I'm great. Good to see you.
Really good to see you. We have a couple movies to talk to you about today. Bringing Out the Dead, the Scorsese film, and Wim Wenders' Perfect Days, which are both on 4K. Bringing Out the Dead is the new Paramount release. It looks gorgeous. Perfect Days, Criterion, complete with an essay by our good friend Bilge Ibiri, which was exciting to see. Always good to read something new by Bilge. These films, let's see, Bringing Out the Dead was part of that really crowded 1999 year of like too many masterpieces. Do you remember the first time you saw it?
Oh, yeah. And I remember being very alone in my effusive praise for the film. It was not well received. If you
it
remember.
Really wasn't. No.
And there was sort of there was this, I just started writing for the Philly Weekly, and there was a terrible other critic there
who shall go unnamed. Yes.
Yeah. Well, they're not a critic anymore.
Okay.
She told me that movie was proof that Scorsese and Schrader were washed up.
Wow.
And but that was sort of the prevailing mentality in 99, right? It was sort of like the new guard. Like, remember, like Eyes Wide Shut was a big bomb. And it was like, I remember she said the same thing about that. Like, it just showed that the old guard in the 60s and 70s mavericks are over. And it's time for the new generation of filmmakers, like Sam Mendes and David O. Russell and all the people who really broke through in 99 and Spike Jones. And if you look at the output now, 25 years later, I mean, Bringing Out the Dead still plays in rep shows here like a lot. It just played a few weeks ago, and it's much more crowded than it was when it came out.
I know. It's really cool to see how many people have latched onto this movie, have kind of reappraised it. I loved it too from the time I saw it. I actually remember buying a used version of the video from Blockbuster. They used to do that. You could get the cheap, you know, previously viewed. And it was in like almost perfect condition. I don't know that anyone really rented the thing. So I had that video.
I can top that. I had a Times Square bootleg.
Did you really? Oh, okay. Sean, you're just cooler.
Which had the awesome crowd noises and stuff. It was one of those shot in the theater camcorder specials you used to buy. Either Times Square or Canal Street, you could buy them. It was a little shaky, but you know, you got the important parts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think this is Cage being Cage. It's interesting because to me, watching it now, it just feels so much fresher and so much more of like a confessional piece from Schrader and Scorsese than some of their more overt religious films. Like, I will watch this 10 times more than I would watch. I do like Last Temptation, of course, but I like this one better. And I think what it says about religion and how deeply personal it is and what we're all doing here and Love Can Save You. It's dark. It's heaven and hell. It's a really profound movie.
Yeah, and I mean, it's pretty overtly religious, too.
Yes.
It's Friday to Sunday, and her name is Mary.
Oh, my God, I know. And the way they use lighting in this film is phenomenal. Yes.
I think it's really interesting, too, for them, like, going back and revisiting so many tropes from Taxi Driver. You know, a lot of time at the time, that was the big criticism that, they're just recycling Taxi Driver stuff. But here, you know, two guys who are older and mellowed. I mean, Christ, Scorsese just made Kundun. You know, he's really trying to mellow out. Mm-hmm. And instead of shooting the drug dealer, Nicolas Cage goes in his house and does drugs with him and then saves his life.
Yeah, it's almost like a crucifixion scene. We have so much going on in this film with blood, and I think Ving Rhames is fabulous too. His like sermons that he gives. Tom Sizemore as Major Tom. I mean, amazing. Yeah, I love all of the cast members. It's a really great film. I remember there was also a criticism about Patricia Arquette in the movie. I think she's really good. I love...
Yeah, I don't like her.
You don't like her very much? No. Yeah, that was
a little flat.
A little flat. Yeah, I don't know. I actually really think you need somebody like that to play off of his manic energy. And maybe it helped that they were a couple at the time. So maybe I kind of went in with that vibe. But yeah, I think it's good. I know he considers it Cage like a misunderstood Scorsese masterpiece. It's also just like letting Cage loose. So we've got the first person traitor thing happening, but he's still making crazy eyes and doing all the Cage-isms, but you need that for this. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, it's such a great vision of that. Like, I mean, it's like a sequel to Taxi Driver and After Hours and Last Temptation all at the same time, you know.
Rolled into one. That's a good way to put it, Sean.
That New York After Midnight scene is just so funny. Just the amount of the chaos in that hospital with the nurse, Mary Beth Hurt, and just, I mean, there's just so much shit happening in every scene, and everyone's so sardonically funny.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you've been doing cocaine for 3 days and, you know, and your heart's beating too fast and you can't sleep and you want us to help. I didn't put the cocaine up your nose. Like, she is just amazing. And also, as somebody with chronic health issues who winds up in ERs way too much, I've heard nurses and doctors, completely paramedics, talking like that to some people, like, you know, coming in the room. So, you still think you're seeing spots? Like, you just, I mean, they just get really, I don't know. Sometimes you're like, where's your humanity? But they would see so much. I've been in a hospital on a full moon and, you know, summer, and it's insane. Saturday nights are crazy. I remember July is like the worst, the deadliest time to go to the hospital. And I wondered why it was. And it's because that's when the new crop of like medical assistants and stuff come in from college, and they don't really have the experience. And so doctors actually statistically will not have their kids do that month. Like, purposely, they have them when, you know, family planning, they will plan not to have their kid in the summer if they can help it. I read an article about that and I thought that was fascinating. So yeah, I mean, you need all the authenticity. Of course, you know a couple things about paramedics, Sean.
I don't remember any of that, though. I was like,
I know.
But yeah, I have been zapped and intubated. I wish I could tell you more.
Yes. My good friend, he's doing fabulous now. He looks amazing. But around Christmas, man.
I got a ride and I didn't even remember it.
Yeah. Luck of the Irish, luck of Sean. He thankfully collapsed in front of a firehouse, and it took 2 zaps, right?
Three zaps.
Oh my God, Burnsy. And
I know, I was watching the movie again and like, wow, that was me. Huh.
Oh my God. Yes. Well, thankfully, right in front of the fire station, they helped him, and he's sitting here today, and that's good. But yeah, I'm glad you don't remember that, actually.
I mean, so am I. Yeah, I missed all the scary parts. I just woke up, everyone was happy to see me. That was
my favorite thing was when you told me your sisters were like, you were hilarious. You were hitting all the nurses.
Oops.
Yeah. Oh, well, he's a charmer, you guys. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, getting back to the movie, I mean, that's what's... It's also, in addition to everything else we've described it as, it's a workplace comedy.
It is. Absolutely.
There's a guy I work with at my other job who, just like John Goodman, from the moment we clock in, he's talking about what we're going to have for dinner.
Yes. I know. And how you're like stuck with these people. There's a great line that Seinfeld once said, like, you don't have to be friends with these people. They just filled out the same job application as you. Like, you're stuck with them. Yeah.
But there's the people who, you know, from the moment they get there, it's, we got to talk about every different restaurant. Well, maybe we'll have this tonight. No. Oh, do you want to do Chinese? No, I'm thinking sub.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, yeah. It's little things like that. Perfect details. Like, the movie feels, because while it's crazy, and it's a crazy looking movie, the Robert Richardson lighting is absolutely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
But it is grounded in that very recognizable everyday behavior.
It is like talking about, I got to get out of here. I'm going to do this. I mean, everyone has a friend like that. Like, I'm going to move. I'm going to change my life. And they never do. I love that shot where Cage just like walks out of the hospital. And we see Sizemore like just beating the shit out of the ambulance. And there's like, he doesn't stop. It just goes on. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, it really is nice to see. The movie, it's got such a, once it popped on Criterion, it seemed like that seems to be the key to these things getting praised, just put them on the Criterion channel, because suddenly there's this whole other generation who likes Nicolas Cage a lot more than people did 10 years ago.
I know. I hated that when everyone was treating him like a punchline. He's one of my favorite actors. Actually, when I had Megan Abbott on, it was like the first episode of season two, we did what she considered to be like underrated or under-discussed Scorsese, and she chose, this was one of the movies that she picked. I love it. And then of course Perfect Days is one of our favorite movies from last year. I'm gonna let you take it away on this one.
It's about cleaning toilets.
You know, he's the most zen character. Every time somebody would say, like, who's your favorite character of the year? And it was weird because the year before, I was obsessed with Marcel the Shell with shoes on. And so, like, I was just like, I want to hang out with Marcel the Shell. And whereas everybody else was like, I want to be, like, hanging with Cate Blanchett and Tar. And I'm like, I love Tar. I want to hang out with Marcel the Shell. And then last year, it was the lead of Perfect Days. Just absolutely Koji Yakusho. If I'm saying that correctly, incorrectly, I apologize. His character is amazing. He cleans public toilets. He listens to classic rock on cassette tape. He just likes driving. He loves books. He takes pictures of plants and trees. He tends to them. He goes to the same bar. He has a crush on the woman that works there. He doesn't know how he should approach or if he should. What I love is it seems like a simple life, but it's extremely fulfilling. It's very zen. But then as the movie goes on, you realize his life is very complicated, just like anyone else's. And it hints at greater depth and greater meaning. And it also kind of goes with the stuff we love about Wenders, about you know, unlikely outsiders in these expansive worlds. Paris, Texas, Alice in the Cities. To me, this kind of feels like it goes back to the Alice in the Cities kind of thing. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it had been a long time since we'd seen a good Wim Wenders fiction film.
one of
the 90s, maybe. Like,
it was rough there for a while. Yeah.
The documentaries are all pretty good, but in terms
they
of
are. Yep.
I thought that ship had sailed in terms of dramatic films with him. They seem to get more extra. It feels like Until the End of the World broke him somehow, like that movie.
Yeah, there were a couple that were rough there in a row. but it was, but
this is such a tight, controlled, like it's just so beautifully, and you don't need that much. It's great. Like, one of my things I hate about so many contemporary films is everything is so overexplained,
and everybody's
backstory has to be
so much convoluted. Yeah,
we have to spin this off into, you know, the franchise mentality where, oh, we could get a prequel explaining what he did before he cleaned toilets. Whereas,
what made him clean toilets? Yes.
Yeah, there'd have to be some sort of, or you know. And I mean, the father is barely mentioned in this. And then, the sister is just like, this is where you live. And you see the sisters in a chauffeured car.
Mm-hmm.
And hey, that's all we need.
Yep. I know you've got the niece, you see like their tender relationship. I loved how they both enjoyed taking photos of trees and just the simple humanity, like his young coworker who has this girlfriend he loves. But also just, and you kind of think one thing of him, he has to rate every single thing he's doing 10 out of 10, 9 out of 10. And, but then you see the way somebody, who's a disabled, individual interacting with him and loving his ears and just how you relate to people again, just like bringing out the dead. It's seeing the humanity in everyone. And, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, and sort of finding fulfillment in your work.
In the everyday, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not so much those toilets are real. I mean, there's no shit in those toilets. It's really something else.
You know, it is. It's when it started and I was like, oh, this is going to gross me out pretty fast, isn't it? If it was an American movie, it would be like so disgusting. You know, he's playing tic-tac-toe with notes left behind. He's helping like a lost kid and, you know, he's getting out of the way if you're in a hurry and you need to use the toilet and he's as embarrassed as you are or, you know, doesn't want you to be embarrassed. And yeah, I think it's a beautiful movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's sort of, you know, it's just a reminder to like, just slow down, take things in, look at the trees, eat your sandwich outside, you know, it's the temptation to have everything move so fast.
Yes. I love the scene where they're playing, I think it was Brown Eyed Girl and with his niece. And she asks, you know, do they have this on Spotify? And it's so cute. He said, I don't know, where is the store? Like he was going to bring her to Spotify the store. And she thought, yeah. And so, you know, everybody kind of wants to unplug and it's good to do that every once in a while. When I was in LA recently, looking around, there's a room of people just being on the phone the whole time while they're with like friends, lovers, business associates. I mean, I don't know their story, but it was, it's different. It's like, let's just enjoy each other, take it a little slower. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw one complaint that, you know, because Vendors is such a music guy.
Yeah.
People are saying, oh, it's such a normie soundtrack with like greatest hits songs. And it's like, yeah, that's like what this guy would be listening to. You know,
he's not going to have a
super obscure record collector.
I know.
Paste. It's like,
yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. We have to listen to Pale Blue Eyes and
Brown Eyed Girl and Sitting
Redondo
on the Dock
Beach
of the Bay.
And like these are amazing songs. Like, what is your problem? Yes.
Yeah. So you know, that's what this guy would be listening to, and they're great fucking songs. So
they are. And you get to hear a woman sing House of the Rising Sun, which is great, in Japanese. Yes. No, it's fabulous. Are there any releases that you either were excited about this summer or are coming up that you're ready to pre-order anything?
No, physical media stuff? No, I got the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid one. I think that was my last big purchase. I was a little disappointed.
You were disappointed.
Well, they did these two like beautiful restorations of the theatrical cut, which was taken away from Peckinpah and Butcher.
Yes.
And then this new 50th anniversary edition, which is not the director's cut.
Mm.
And then they have the original director's cut and they like just dumped this crappy scan of it on there.
Oh no, that's not good.
It actually doesn't look as good as the one on the previous Turner disc, although it's a slightly different. There were two preview edits. It's a long story with that movie. Basically, what happened with that movie was Peckinpah had a chance to make his edit before they took it away.
Yeah.
And then stole it out of the projection room. Like he had his buddies load the reels into their trunk. And it was like the movie was moved around people's houses and stuff for years. Because the studio had cut it and butchered it so much. And originally the Peckinpah pals that had stolen it forgot to steal the sound reels. And someone called up the office, Peckinpah's office, and said, there's been a very dumb theft. Someone took the picture and they forgot the sound. And if they don't come back by 5 when I report that it was stolen, they won't be able to have the sound that went with the movie.
Oh my God, I love that story. Wow.
So I just thought it was strange of Criterion not to use
not
that
to,
as their version. Instead, there's this other editor named Paul Cedar who's been recutting. He did a recut of the movie like 10 years ago, too. He keeps changing it according to what he thinks Sam would have done. And it's like, or you could just go by the one Sam did. I don't know.
I would want to watch that version for sure. And of course, you were involved in a recent release, writing the essay for Bad Lieutenant for Imprint. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I got to write about Bad Lieutenant. That was great. It was I got to introduce a screening of it at the Coolidge Corner Theater. It was this great midnight screening. There were a bunch of people who hadn't seen it before. And,
amazing.
I hope they're okay. Yeah, I mean, that was a very important movie. I saw that when I was 17 years old. I just turned 17 when it came out. It was NC-17. I got carded at the theater and I got to hold up my ID. But
yeah.
You know, and just in terms of showing me what like a movie could do to be like this complete gutter trash, like vile movie that's also these incredibly elevated spiritual concerns, but it's expressing them in this really low down way. And it really, you know, I mean, imagine watching that when you're 17. It's something else.
Yeah.
But I mean, it shows you, you know, what it just seems there is a level of, movies trying to get away with murder that doesn't really happen anymore.
Like, yeah, absolutely. No, that's a really good point. People are calling things risky. I mean, there's stuff just done for shock value now, and then stuff is over applauded for being risky when it really isn't. And yeah, you know, we're talking about, hey, the 90s again with Bad Lieutenant, Bringing Out the Dead. Like, try some stuff, filmmakers. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Bringing Out the Dead was a big budget studio picture, which is funny. Like, that was a big Paramount thing. I can't imagine Paramount making a movie like that now, you know?
No, not at all. Yeah, it would have to be an existing IP or something. Right. Something they can put on Paramount Plus safely.
Ambulance Driver.
Yes, exactly.
Can we make his the name Travis?
Yeah, the new procedural for CBS. Yes.
So it would have to be a sequel to Taxi Driver in some way, right? Like, we're part of the Taxi Driver universe. Like, there would have to be, like Senator Palantine would have to be in it.
Yes. Oh, my God.
The girl would have to be Iris all grown up, right? Like, that would be Patricia Arquette. Like, I could see the executive.
She runs the cab company. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, exactly. Well, Sean, I want to thank you so much for doing this, talking about two great movies and some of the stuff you're working on, and Pat Garrett, Billy the Kid. Come back anytime.
I will.
Okay, next up we have The Linguini Incident, the director's cut, which was released by MVD Visual on Blu-ray. It is filled with special features, so many interviews, audio commentary, introduction, a documentary that's full length about the making of this movie from director Richard Shepard. This movie came out in 1991, and it actually, I don't know why I was getting it so confused with another film. I did see it back in the early 90s because I was a big fan of Rosanna Arquette, and of course you also have David Bowie in this movie. Kind of a silly one where Rosanna Arquette is desperate for cash and she wants to be an escape artist. David Bowie is working at this restaurant and he's the new bartender, she's a waitress, and it's a terminally hip, that's the phrase they're using on the back of the box, New York City restaurant, kind of one of those places I wouldn't like to go in, they're just not relaxing to me. Bowie needs somebody to marry, anyone to marry really, by the end of the week, because otherwise, you know, he has to go back to England. And so they strike forces and decide that they're going to solve each other's problems. One of the ways they want to do that is to rob the restaurant. Another person in this movie that kind of steals every scene she's in, although she seems to be from a different planet, a lot of the parts of the movie don't really add up. They seem very bizarre. Is Esther Balint, who was in Stranger Than Paradise, and she stole every scene she was in that movie. Here she is a lingerie designer who kind of designs like self-defense bras. It's sort of a running gag. Things get weirder and weirder. And in case you're listening to this and wondering like what the hell I'm talking about, this sort of was one of those New York 80s movies that came after the Rosanna Arquette star vehicle, Desperately Seeking Susan, which really was supposed to launch Rosanna, but became like the Madonna movie. And this is not Desperately Seeking Susan, which is a film I love. I remembered liking this one way more than I actually did. This is the director's cut. I realized, though, while I was watching the film, that I actually had it confused with another one that came out in the early 90s that I think was made for television with Tay Leone called The Counterfeit Contessa, which was one of those movies I saw like on a sick day pretty much on TV, and it was just dumb and funny and, you know, sort of a fairy tale rom-com setup, but it actually was very delightful. I thought Tay Leone was great. So I don't know. Of course, I'm going from my memory as a 13-year-old watching that movie in like 1994. It could be a disaster, so don't take me on it now. But unfortunately, I just didn't love the Linguini incident, but I liked a lot of the things about it. Of course, this cast, there's some ingenuity here, some clever ideas. It's probably worth watching once, but I can't fully recommend it. That is the Linguini incident. Okay, so we are going from pasta, linguine, to a different type of spaghetti. We're talking about spaghetti westerns, kind of the granddaddy of all spaghetti westerns and spaghetti western filmmakers, of course, is Sergio Leone. By the time we reached 1968, he was ready to retire from making westerns. He made the Man with No Name trilogy, and after that, which are kind of known as like the greatest westerns, he wanted out. He wanted to make the film Once Upon a Time in America, which was based on the novel The Hoods. He would eventually make that film, but Paramount offered him a really great budget and Henry Fonda, and they made an offer and he got back in the Western business, because why wouldn't you? Especially when you're dealing with a story that comes from not only Sergio Leone, but also Dario Argento and Bernardo Bertolucci. So, I mean, this is like, there's Italian movies and then there's Italian movies, and this is the latter. This is like the most Italian of the spaghetti westerns. When you're talking about, like, my goodness, guys, you have Argento, Bertolucci, Leone, and he wrote the script along with Sergio Donati. Also, you have an incredible cinematographer, Antonino Delli Colli. You also have one of the greatest scores by Ennio Morricone, outdoing his scores in some respects. It's really hard to choose a favorite Morricone score. I think, you know, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is brilliant. There's, of course, Days of Heaven, The Mission. You know, he is a master. There's some really cool things that he does in Once Upon a Time in the West, and I'll tie back in with Ennio Morricone in a moment. But before we do that, let's talk about Once Upon a Time in the West. This is a brand new release that came out this summer from Paramount. It's in 4K, Ultra HD. It looks gorgeous. It also included a digital copy of the film, so you can watch it anytime. There is a Blu-ray as well. I kind of love it when they do that, so you don't have to buy the movie multiple times in case you have different formats, or if you want to watch it on the go. Although, my God, this is not a movie to watch on your phone, people. Don't do that. But Disc 2 comes with some really cool extra features. We're talking about commentary by the hosts of Spaghetti Western Podcast. I don't know that podcast. I haven't really spent too much time there, but sounds good to me. But here's where the film really shines, or this release, I should say. It also has commentary with contributions from directors who revere it, like John Carpenter, John Milius, Alex Cox, film historians, multiple film historians, and cast and crew members. Has also a look back with Leonard Maltin, special features called like an opera of violence, which I'm sure goes into the Morricone score, Wages of Sin, something to do with death, Railroad revolutionizing the West, and locations then and now, production galleries, and more. This is a film about greed. It's a film about water. Like I said before, when I was reading that, Railroad as well. Such a great cast. Claudia Cardinale, Henry Fonda, Jason Robards, Charles Bronson, Woody Strode. Just, it goes on and on. Now, I will say, of course, Sergio Leone, for as brilliant as he is, dude had some issues with women. My goodness. I mean, you know, watch his movies, watch Once Upon a Time in America, which that would be a whole other podcast. But these issues kind of go throughout his filmography, and you see it here. He didn't seem to understand. There was like famously, like, who was the protagonist in this movie or what was the deal? And you know what? Cardinale, I mean, she is playing a complicated character, but she is extremely fascinating. She does get, you know, mistreated throughout. There's some issues with women, like we're saying, with some of these Leone films, just like other masters of this era, Peckinpah. And again, that could be its own book, its own podcast. We're not going to go into all of that. But she is great here. And I think, of course, it would be more interesting if they actually gave her more agency and more things to say and do. I do think she's an underrated talent in this film. And so I do love Cardinale. Of course, you know, you have Henry Fonda, who is just scary as hell in this movie. And also you have Jason Robards. You have a lot going on with those two. Charles Bronson arriving into town with a harmonica. And that's where we get into Ennio Morricone wanting to have fun. He was a very playful composer. And so I think one thing that's really cool, just kind of like the sound of like whips and things that we heard in his Good, the Bad, the Ugly score and some of the operatic elements that we heard in his earlier scores. He's having a little bit of fun here in Once Upon a Time in the West. So he is a composer who loved doing that. In the documentary Ennio, the Maestro, aka Ennio, which is also known as the Glance of Music, which I don't understand that title at all. Please don't call it that. That's not cool, man. Ennio, he is a guy who sometimes would just write music while he was on the phone paying his phone bill, which is bananas. He is someone who, when I saw the documentary Ennio, which is another film that I'm talking about in this physical media episode, which also came on DVD and was made by Giuseppe Tornatore, when I went to see this documentary last year at the Academy Museum, introducing the film were a series of guests, including Giuseppe Tornatore and one of Morricone's sons. And Morricone's sons said something really interesting about their dad. He said that, you know, he was loving. He didn't really have too many strict rules about things with them. But the one rule that he did have was no music in the home because it would impact his scores. And he would just always be hearing sounds anyway throughout the day and getting ideas for things and deciding that he was going to compose off of three notes just to challenge himself or off of a beloved piece of music. Or he was always kind of making things a little more playful and trying to keep himself on his toes. And I think creatively, the score for Once Upon a Time in the West is Morricone having a ball and doing some of that. And in the Ennio documentary, which was not released by Paramount, I should give a shout out to the actual producer of that one. That is Music Box Films, the distributor. So go ahead and pick that up. But in Ennio, he talks about composing that harmonica piece for Once Upon a Time in the West. So these films make really good companions with one another. So if you are a fan of spaghetti westerns and Sergio Leone films and Ennio Morricone, this is a really cool double feature. You could also do it sort of as a Christmas present now that we're getting into fall. I'm coming up with Christmas present ideas all the time. So it might be kind of a cool way to package a gift for a film lover in your life who's a big fan of westerns and Morricone and Leone, who went to primary school together, which is a little detail that I love from the documentary. The documentary is great. It has a number of talking heads, some famous filmmakers who were huge admirers of Morricone, some people who knew him, of course. One person that I will say I feel like should have been in this documentary and the entire time, and it's a 156-minute documentary that I was waiting for, who was not in it at all, was Yo-Yo Ma. Maybe Yo-Yo Ma was busy. I don't know what was going on, but Yo-Yo Ma released one of my favorite albums, which is dedicated to the music of Morricone. So it's Yo-Yo Ma doing Morricone music. It's one of the most beautiful albums that you will find. It's makes some of the scores that Morricone did just much more haunting to be played on strings. And I think, you know, I would have loved to have seen Yo-Yo Ma talking about these pieces a little bit or having some more musicians. Like, it's very cool to see big fans who use their music, you know, like Bruce Springsteen uses it in concert and all these other people in this documentary. It's cool to hear, you know, fans like everyone from, well, Quentin Tarantino, who worked with him, but, you know, Clint Eastwood was a collaborator. You have Oliver Stone, all of these great filmmakers and voices and all the experimental stuff that he did. But I was kind of looking for more musical talking heads as well. Another aspect of the documentary that I love, and I'm waiting for someone to release a box set or some kind of album of his 60s, 50s and 60s pop music, because as you see in this documentary, he released so many great pop songs in Italy. And I found myself just completely mesmerized. Of course, I had my phone off when I saw this documentary at the Academy Museum. But once I was able to play it at home, I just kept Shazamming the hell out of every track in order to try to track down all of these songs. And I think if they somehow put together a Morricone Italian pop music album from the 60s, I think, you know, this would be just opening up a whole new level of fandom for the Morricone estate and his legacy. From Once Upon a Time in the West to Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Recently, Arrow sent me the new 3-pack of the Mexico trilogy from director Robert Rodriguez. When Arrow sends discs, they don't send me the finished product, so I don't have the box that lists everything. I do have a printout of bonus features, and these are stacked, you guys. But just to let you know, these are press discs, so every once in a while things change. But the edition that I received had one 4K disc, and that was Desperado. Strangely enough, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, which is my favorite of the series, was not available in 4K, which is a little odd. You would think that because it's the newest film that they would have put that one out in 4K as well. I can understand holding off on El Mariachi, the movie that started it all, because it was made on the cheap. And so I don't know that 4K would do a whole lot for it. But overall, this is a wonderful edition released a few months before Christmas. So if you're like me and you're already starting to get some ideas of presents that you would love to surprise your family and friends with, I would say this is a really cool one to add to the list, Robert Rodriguez Mexico trilogy. And I'm going to go through the movies. It was kind of nice to be able to revisit these films because the one I watch all the time is Once Upon a Time in Mexico. I hadn't seen El Mariachi or Desperado since the 90s, essentially. And so I think this was a really good opportunity to revisit them in this gorgeous new edition and see some of the bonus features, interviews, commentary, little featurettes. Robert Rodriguez is so generous and open about his process and wanting to encourage and inspire others. He was one of the class of 92 Sundance, along with, of course, Tarantino, Allison Anders, Alexander Rockwell, and others. And so his sort of film school in a box approach has delighted fans all across his films, little ones with the Spy Kids franchise all the way up to Machete and those movies as well. If you watch his films, you can see how they achieved some of the cool effects, some of the editing techniques, action sequences. One thing I love about Rodriguez is he is kind of a one-man filmmaking machine. He writes, directs. He's sort of had that great credit for a while that was like shot, chopped, scored, like he did it all, essentially. Now, when El Mariachi took off and then Desperado was made for way more money and higher profile and just amazing collaborators, he took a backseat on some of the departments, and in some of the subsequent films that followed, of course, he worked with just, you know, top of the line talent behind and in front of the camera. But then Once Upon a Time in Mexico, he kind of got back in touch with those roots. So that's something I always loved. And it made the film particularly special. I think it was a way for him to fall back in love with the type of filmmaking that got him into his career. And so that's something I think that was always very special about it. Of course, it's, you know, just filled to the brim with amazing people in that film. But behind the scenes, it's a lot of Rodriguez doing his thing. But let me go ahead and backtrack and start with El Mariachi. When I revisited these mid-August, like basically right before I was getting ready to go to LA to host the film screening of White Palace at the American Cinematheque on behalf of Watch With Jen, I watched these movies and I was jotting down notes in Letterboxd. And so I wrote a couple reviews that I'm just going to read out loud to you and share my thoughts. So here we go with El Mariachi. I said the ingenuity, the playfulness, the subjective camera, you know immediately that you're watching a film by a natural visual storyteller who's only going to improve with more resources and experience. And as modest as El Mariachi is, that's exciting as hell. This picture should be mandatory film school production class viewing. You don't just have to leave the camera static. You don't need to follow the playbook of television with shot, reaction, shot, cutting. Techniques like fast motion sprinkled in sparingly can be crazy fun. Your heritage and your unique POV is your greatest strength. creativity isn't dependent on money, and you shouldn't be afraid to take risks, to try things, and to fail, because messy but ambitiously original is always better than safe but blandly forgettable. El Mariachi, of course, is the film that was made for, I believe it was $7,000. He enrolled in a medical experiment, kind of one of those test things where he got paid for his time. I think the legend was he wrote his script while he was recovering. I don't know if that's 100% true, but boy, is it a nice story. I think he got paid something like $9,000, and it was a little over 7.5. So he didn't spend all of his dough, but probably for the promotion of the film, he did. This one got into Sundance. It was a huge word of mouth hit, and Sony picked it up. It was distributed. I think it is the most successful film made for the least amount of money. It's a film about a mariachi looking for work, and he is mistaken for an assassin who is going around with weaponry in his guitar case. It's a simple setup, but it's done extremely effectively. And I do love the amount of creativity, because I am someone who went to film school. I've judged movies coming into film festivals and from newcomers. And a lot of the times you do get, especially young men starting out who watch a lot of crime movies, back in the 90s, it was always about a drug deal gone bad, or like there was one car chase or something. And every once in a while, there'd be a cool technique, but mostly it was just like shot, reaction shot. And then everybody holds up their, you know, squirt guns or whatever it was. And then, you know, everyone is dead, essentially, but one guy who walks away with the cash, sometimes with a babe, sometimes without. And so the setup is something that you see all the time, but El Mariachi takes it a few steps further. It is super creative. I think you're willing to overlook some of the contrivances in the plot, that kind of thing, because just the fresh eyes, the enthusiasm, the excitement, you can just feel that this is a film made by people who are really enjoying the medium and what it is capable of. They're not just trying to be famous, essentially, or just trying to get it done. Sometimes in film school, you see that people wasting their money or their parents' money, and they're just like trying to get done, essentially. No, Rodriguez wants to make this. I mean, he was willing to enroll in some study, do everything he could, and get this movie made. And yeah, El Mariachi still works damn well, and it holds up. I hate that phrase when people ask you, oh, does, you know, insert name of a classic film hold up? And it's like, to who? To what? What does hold up mean? But El Mariachi, let's just say it works. It works regardless of when it was made, regardless of what year you're watching it in. I think it's terrific. And so I do encourage you to check out El Mariachi if you haven't. If your kids are in film school or you're a film professor, maybe throw this in the curriculum. Maybe put this on as part of a double feature one night when you're watching something else that Rodriguez made or something in this medium. It might be interesting to put this on right before one of the god-awful movies that are made for streaming, for Netflix, that, you know, all these films that are so interchangeable that you forget immediately some of these movies that are being made. Put this on right before it and then watch one of those with, you know, starring The Rock or Gal Gadot or whoever is in these films, and where it's like them against a green screen, and tell me which one feels more alive. A movie that stars nobody that you've ever heard of in your life, probably friends of Robert Rodriguez and people who showed up to a casting call and friends of friends, versus, you know, marquee talent. Of course, The Rock is fun to watch, but I would rather watch El Mariachi than some of these films that are being made for Apple and Netflix and Hulu. They're Amazon, all of these things lately. They're just interchangeable. El Mariachi, not so much. Desperado, I remember really enjoying when it came out, but being a little disenchanted with the way it went from El Mariachi to this. You sort of saw the indulgence in Rodriguez has kind of a juvenile or a more crass sense of humor in places. And anyone who knows me well knows that's a huge turnoff for me. I don't really like scatological humor. I think it's kind of like the cheapest and the most basic way to make somebody laugh. And it kind of is just gross out for gross out's sake. And it's juvenile. It's not my thing. So there are some scenes here where you're just like, did we need that? I mean, I hate that phrase as well, but it kind of takes away from it. Of course, his movies are also all about the babes and, you know, they're over the top. You have Salma Hayek looking just stunningly beautiful in this movie. You have a sex scene that is extremely gratuitous. Like, I remembered that. I also remember Salma Hayek talking about getting ready for the sex scene and like this bikini waxing thing that went crazy. The only thing I remember, or the only reason I remember that, is just because she told this ridiculous story where you were just like, ouch. And also thinking about just how graphic it was. And again, that's kind of out of nowhere. So some of his impulses as a filmmaker, you know, he is sort of indulging sides of himself that he got a bigger platform. He got more money, more talent, and used it extremely effectively with the cast. You have Antonio Banderas, my God, you know, from the Almodovar movies. You do have Salma Hayek, who is a star in her native Mexico, and this was one of her big crossover films. And so this kind of made them both international superstars. I mean, Banderas beyond some of these art house Almodovar films in his native Spain. But some of the elements I remember being a little bit turned off by at the time. This one played a lot better for me now. I still am kind of like, on a couple of things. It sort of seems like it was made by like a college guy or a young guy, which it was at the time. And it's a little over the top in places, for better and worse. I mean, you're willing to overlook it if it's a blast, and this movie is a blast, and so I will overlook some of it. Also, it is a film that was in love with the cool factor, and so it is completely soaked in 90s Tarantino. Like, I don't know, if you weren't there, you can't remember how he became like an overnight rock star, essentially. There's this horrible movie called like Destiny Turns on the Radio, where he's walking around like almost like an Elvis or a Jesus type figure, Tarantino. He was in a Broadway version of Wait Until Dark with Marissa Tomei. I mean, he just kind of got to do whatever. So there's a scene where Tarantino walks into a bar and tells a really disgusting story, and it's just him being cool. And so this is very like a movie of its time. But overall, it is still just tons of fun. It's kind of taking the premise of the original and going from there. It's sort of not a remake, not a sequel, but kind of somewhere in the middle. And it's a blast. I mean, I do have to say this is better than El Mariachi as a film overall. I will say that now, especially looking back and watching it in 2024, and also just seeing how inspired it is, again, compared to these action garbage movies that we're getting so much of the time. I just saw that new one with Casey Affleck and Matt Damon that was made for Apple. And, you know, I can't even remember these titles after you see them. There was another one called like Jackpot, made for Amazon. I don't know where they're getting these movies. But when you watch something like Desperado, it just, My friend Jordan Harper says it, like every film made before 2000 is getting retroactively better, even if it wasn't a great film, just because we're not making movies that looked this beautiful, that actually had lighting, that actually, you know, just had fun, big action pieces of filmmaking that were made with practical effects and real cars and not just all CG. So Desperado is a blast, and I'll read you my thoughts on Letterboxd about this one. I said it is El Mariachi post Sundance and QT with the power of a big studio behind him. And the two greatest improvements are the action sequences and the megawatt cast, including supporting player Steve Buscemi in a highly verbal storytelling role and Danny Trejo as a knife-throwing, silent but deadly assassin who can stare people down with the best of them. Salma Hayek and Antonio Banderas became international sensations off this film, even though both had careers in their home countries. And from Desperado, Rodriguez spiraled into his own brand of grindhouse action before the Spy Kids franchise made him and his cast of frequent collaborators beloved around the globe and across generations. My favorite of his Mexico trilogy titles is the third film by far, but this shows that he has a true love of epic storytelling. However, Desperado also puts on display his outsized, mischievous sense of humor, which amuses but goes too far at times. The film's tone doesn't fully gel, and it makes you miss El Mariachi's less is more approach. Still, he's throwing everything he has at this film to see what sticks. And what does is once again our understanding that Rodriguez has creativity to spare. So like I said, essentially, we're seeing somebody just having fun making a movie and using the medium instead of just treating it like a product. Like he's grocery shopping, essentially, like get an actor, put him in a film and, you know, make a cool poster and then you'll forget it tomorrow, and, you know, making it like a consumer product. Once Upon a Time in Mexico sort of again takes this idea. You do have Antonio Banderas, you have Salma Hayek, Eva Mendes, Willem Dafoe. It's just a film that is filled with people, Johnny Depp, Cheech Marin. I love that film. It is a blast. Once I was asked to host a screening of it, and the spontaneous applause throughout the movie, just by an audience enjoying themselves, was awesome to witness. It is something I won't forget because we don't really have that. Also, it shows you just what the experience is like of seeing a movie as a group and communally. And, you know, that's something that can't be duplicated at home. As annoying as the movie going experience can be with people talking and laughing in the wrong times at rep screenings, some of those too cool for school assholes that have to laugh at things that, you know, were made in the 80s or something. It's still just such a great experience. The sound, the picture, to just go to a place with strangers and enjoy something. You know, there's nothing like that. Films play differently with a crowd. And Once Upon a Time in Mexico is definitely one of those movies. I would say all of Tarantino's films, even the ones I don't like, even the Rodriguez movies I don't like, you know, these are movies that really kind of soar on the enjoyment of the audience. Sometimes we're laughing at the wrong things in terms of, well, both of their films, but especially Tarantino, but that's a whole other podcast. But these movies are great. I think having them available as a three-pack and showing his progression as a filmmaker would inspire people who want to get into filmmaking. And there's so many wonderful extra features that show off the physical media medium that you're not going to get in streaming. And so people have lost appreciation or understanding for what it takes to make a film. And Rodriguez was always extremely giving and open to letting people in so they could experience that and understand it. And he wasn't snobby about it. And, you know, I love that these bonus features have been preserved. There's new ones. It's really cool. So Bravo Arrow, I would highly recommend this set. Well, next up, we have a contemporary comedy classic from 2004. It is the 20th anniversary, which makes everyone feel old, of Anchorman, the Will Ferrell comedy, Anchorman, the Legend of Ron Burgundy. It's the Judd Apatow produced film directed by Adam McKay, starring Will Ferrell, Paul Rudd, Steve Carell, Christina Applegate, Dave Ketchner, and more. Fred Willard. The list goes on. It is hilarious. It takes place in the 1970s in San Diego. You stay classy, San Diego. And we're dealing with an all-male news team, male-dominated world of news. The beautiful Christina Applegate arrives. She is a reporter on the rise who wants to be the first female anchor and turns everything upside down in the newsroom. She and Will Ferrell's character can't stand each other when they first meet. Of course, there's attraction there and they get involved and then they have to be torn apart, just like most romantic comedy themed films work. It's filled with so many great one-liners. It's a film that is highly quotable, and I don't even know. It used to be the leather-bound books, and I'm kind of a big deal. I have to say that was my go-to. I loved that whole scene. Now I'm kind of leaning towards the nonsensical Paul Rudd, the Sex Panther, and, you know, 70% of the time it works every time or something like that. I love that one. I also enjoy the whole fight sequence between all of the networks. You have Ben Stiller showing up with Como Ostabiches. You have Tim Robbins there from PBS. Just every news group. Luke Wilson shows up. All the little cameos, which, you know, don't detract, because in this case, they're used exceptionally well. And it's very, very funny. I am someone who actually prefers the film Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby. I think that is the one I watch the most. It could be because I watched this way too much when it first came out, but there's something about Ricky Bobby, and I think it might be, honestly, that there are so many wonderfully funny roles for women in that movie. You wouldn't think it going in. You think, oh, this is a, you know, film about racing and it's going to be heavily male dominated, and it is, but there are multiple scene stealing women in that. Whereas this, it's mostly Christina Applegate, who's amazing. And there are a couple of really great bit parts for women in this movie, but I do lean towards that one. Although, come on, you guys, this is Anchorman. It is hilarious. I do have to say, if you already own this movie, it isn't one that you necessarily need to rush out and buy in the 4K release for the 20th anniversary of the film. I've seen this countless times. I have a really good 4K setup with audio. I have a TV that's well over 70 inches. I wasn't seeing something too extreme in the visual or the sonic differences of 4K. I don't know if it's just the way this was shot, maybe the high key lighting, the contrast. It wasn't really giving me, oh my God, you need this film in 4K immediately. So if you already have this in DVD and Blu-ray and you're wondering what's next, or you own it in digital, maybe don't rush out and buy the 4K unless you want it. This is a really cool set. It does come with 4K, a Blu-ray, and a digital copy. So if you only have it in DVD and you want to upgrade, then this is a really perfectly good option for you because you have several different formats to showcase the film in. It includes the theatrical and the unrated version of the movie. And, you know, it's hilarious. It'll cheer you up if you're having a bad day. It's a great sick day movie. So, you know, there's really nothing going against Anchorman, but I would say if you're trying to save your money and you only want to buy the 4K releases you need, you can definitely hold off on this one. Other Paramount releases have been just far more visually stellar. So I will say that for this. And that's Anchorman. Well, next up, we have my good friend Blake Howard of One Heat Minute Productions, the most prolific, hardest working man in pod business himself. Blake, when you're talking about Michael Mann, I mean, I got to talk to Blake, especially because this was right after he went to LA, his triumphant Miami Vice screening with Katie Walsh on behalf of Miami Nice with Michael Mann, and the man showed up at LAX, Tom Cruise style, in a suit. Tell me more about that, Blake.
Thank you, Jen, for having me. Look, Katie's favorite Michael Mann movie is Collateral. And she was so kind, my great co-host. I was staying with her and she was picking me up from LAX. And I thought, well, if I'm really a good friend, I should commit to the bit and dress Vincent Collateral style in a gray suit with a tie and have the sunglasses and just wait for her to pick me up so she can be Jason Statham and run into me in LAX. Now, all of the facade of cool that Vincent has, I immediately evaporated from my body when I saw my friends, because friend of this show too, Travis Woods, our friend, and Katie came to pick me up together to surprise me. I had a lot of surprising elements before surprising the audience with Michael Mann at that wonderful screening. And so I was just dressed up like that. And they're like, you were on a flight for 15 hours from Australia wearing that suit. And I go, yes, I was. So it was just mainly
you didn't
to amuse
change
Katie.
In the bathroom, like over the ocean? No. Wow.
No. I thought like, you know, when you've got carry-on, I had carry-on, I had a little bag. I was like, man, I don't want to get onto a flight, be in comfortable clothes, then change into a suit and then have to, I just was like, I don't want the headache. So I was like, I'm going. And you know what I can say? You get treated with a hell of a lot more respect when you're in a suit. Like there was like people in our customs, in Australian customs, that were like picking on people who were like slowly going the line. They go, look, this man's got business to take care of, right? Can we move this along? I was like, oh, wow, I should wear a suit more often. But yeah, so no, it was purely a gesture of for me to amuse Katie Walsh when I saw her. And I was very pleased that when I arrived in LA and it was like, you know, 35 degrees Celsius, which is like 90s degrees, that I was, we were able to stop and I was able to change into some shorts and a shirt to be comfortable once I was bombing around LA, as opposed to having to continue to rock the Vincent Collateral suit. So that was it.
Yeah. The Vincent Collateral suit. Everyone knows that is his official name.
His official name. Yeah. Yes. Confirmed by writer Stuart Patey on our show. So
did you get it like paged over LAX? Did you like think that far ahead? Like, you know what? I'm going to scare them by like having
no.
them. No,
honestly, LAX is so massive. you know, when you're in Australia, you know, if you ever come to Australia, like we have a big international airport, but like there's certain spots where like you can be. And I was kind of trying to be explicit to Katie and Travis, which I didn't know was there at the time, about like where I would be, because like I came out and I was like, I don't know if this is like the main exit of international. Yeah. Like there's a couple of exits in Sydney Airport, but there's like four or five spots that you can come out of customs. And I was like, man, I don't want to screw this up and Katie's gone to the other side of the airport. Like, I don't know what to do. So I was just like more concerned that I was directing her to the right spot. And it was 6 a.m. and I'd been up for like 15 hours. I didn't sleep really a wink on the plane on the way over. So I was at that stage pretty delirious. But yeah, I was still suited up. The friends were very happy to see me dressed as a bozo in a Vincent's suit. But yeah, you got to commit to the bit, Jen. You know this about me.
Yes.
You got to commit to the bit.
Yes, you are a guy who showed up to talk about Apocalypse Now as Dennis Hopper for the Dennis Hopper episode. When Donald and I logged on to talk about sneakers, you were in the turtleneck. I mean, you were ready, man.
Got to be ready. You got to be ready.
Yes. Got to stay winning. Vincent Collateral, you know. And I love this movie. I don't know. I think I told you the story of seeing this on vacation. I went with my dad to visit a relative. We did not like said relative's wife at the time. They're divorced. We're okay about that now.
We're okay
and we just like needed to get the hell out of the house. And I'm like, you know what? There's a new Michael Mann. We're going. And we get to the nightclub scene, like the middle of it. You know, everything is going off. And my dad just like turns to me. Best part of the trip so far. Like, yes. Always go to the movies on vacation for sure.
You do need to escape. There is absolutely an essential thing where it's like, let's go see a movie so we don't have to talk to people that we don't want to talk to anymore. Yes. Yeah. I can't remember. I definitely saw this at the theater, but I can't remember. I don't have like as vivid a cooler memory as that. I just remember like seeing it and I was like, straight away, I was like, I love this movie.
Yeah.
I loved it from the moment I saw it. It's really punchy. It's economical. It's the fastest Michael Mann movie pretty much, unless you go back to things like The Keep or Jericho Mile. Most of his films are 2 hours and change. Some of them, you know, 165 minutes, like Heat, like lengthy. And even like The Insiders, like two hours and 35 or 2 hours 40 or something like that. So like he tends to have the longer movies, but I just love the economy of the storytelling. It does not slow down. It's amazing. And it's a movie that probably, made me kind of a lunatic when I went to LA, cause I just would see signs and see things from movies like Collateral and like call out street signs or call out the names of hospitals or call out crazy things. So, no, I have a great deal of fondness, and I just, how would I describe this? Like it's not lost on me how cool it is that two utter obsessive filmmaking psychos like Tom Cruise and Michael Mann work together on this, because little fastidious things that other filmmakers kind of, they don't have these instincts or don't have this like, desire to reach this sort of zenith. Like he and Tom Cruise, I imagine just like had amazing chemistry. And my true favorite story, you know, talking about Collateral is like on the set one day, Michael's shooting a shot and it's a very basic shot. It's one of Vincent walking up an apartment stairs to get into one of his, one of his target's apartments. And he walks up, and in the film, the final version of the film, whether you're watching on Blu-ray or whether you're watching, now you're watching it on beautiful 4K, you watch a little plane flicker over his head. And in one of the previous takes that they'd done, they got that. And then Michael kept shooting the same boring walk scene over and over again. And Tom sort of walked over to Michael going, oh, am I doing something wrong? Do I need to make an adjustment? And in true Michael Mann fashion, he's like, no, there was just in one of the shots, there was a plane. And I just want to get that again because it just, I don't know, it just gave something magical to the shot. And the story goes that Tom Cruise is like, oh, my plane's at my airfield south of Los Angeles. So Tom Cruise's personal plane, he had a pilot fly over and they timed it and executed it so that the plane could flicker. And that's Tom Cruise's plane flying overhead at night to make it happen. So that's, this movie is stuffed with those kinds of things, and I think it's just so beautiful, and it's a fantastic LA movie. After recently being in LA, I think it means a whole lot more to me because you can actually feel the geography of the city, and it's really excellent. And and on 4K it does look different because a lot of people are kind of like, why would you do 4K with digital photography like this? Why would you even bother? But I think that the depth of field is so crazy in Collateral, and the higher the resolution, it actually becomes more, you can sort of tell the kind of dreamlike compositions of these LA nights, which you can only see under these very, I don't know, they're like weird tonal desert landscape thing, whatever it does to the streetlights at night. It kind of feels so like you are actually there. So I love this movie.
It's textural, it's haunting as the night goes on. And I like what you were saying about the pacing and how this movie does go by, but my favorite thing about it is actually the opening sequence, because it's like a good solid, it's slow, it's like taking us through this man's day. We get to know him, we get a glimpse of some of the other characters, but then when Jada Pinkett Smith gets in the cab he or she and Jamie Foxx have this sort of date that kind of plays out in real time as he's driving her to his destination. And it's beautiful. So many filmmakers would be like, what, you know, would do this? And then the studio would give them notes and they chop it down and chop it down and chop it down. And you need the movie to breathe. You need that relationship to build, because the end of it really harks back to the beginning, and you need that in order for it to pay off so well. And he is, I think, one of our most romantic filmmakers. And it's movies like this that talk about the loneliness of man, his existential thing. I mean, the man's name is man for a reason, I think, really pays off. And I think it's really beautiful. It's one of my favorites for sure.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun. So our podcast, Miami Nice, occasionally does dalliances into other modern man stuff. You know, we've talked about, we talk more extensively probably about Collateral than anything else. We have it's our own little breakout with, which is called Collateral Confessions. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about Ferrari on a couple of special Ferrari Nice episodes. We've spoken about Black Hat too. We try and dance around the modern man stuff. And this one felt like it needed a little bit more focus because, you know, Katie and I have got such an affection and affinity for this movie too, because it's really the one that, you know, people were sort of like lauding as a return to form and led him into things like mm-hmm. Miami Vice. And so much of the stylistic flourish and just man's style is like expressed digitally in Collateral more than any other movie. So yeah, I love it. And I love that it's getting, I had to pluck my own Collateral 4K for you off of my Michael Mann ones. Shelf.
Yes.
Yeah. Two yeah. So I've got, the, I've got, you've got the new Paramount one. I've got the recent one, but I had to pluck it off the Michael Mann shelf where all the Michael Mann movies sit in my
shelf
library.
Of honor.
Yeah. It's, he gets his own shelf in here. I think a one-hit minute production studio should have a Michael Mann shelf, and it does, just so people know.
It's a requirement. One question I have to kind of go back to another one of your podcasts is, this is one of those films, no matter how many times I see it, I always forget temporarily that like Mark Ruffalo shows up almost from a different movie. He shows up with a porn stash. He like enters a scene after a murder, like, you know, like he's a detective. It's like, wait a minute, are we in a procedural all of a sudden? But what I love is we're dealing with cabs and crimes, and it's Ruffalo, and the way it's shot, and it's the dark, and it kind of makes you think, does he get Zodiac without this? Did Fincher see this and go, you know what? He is commanding when he's solving crimes around cabs.
I think that's a great take. And yeah, I actually think it is that Fincher saw him in Collateral, to be honest, that got him for Detective Toshi. But big shout out to Fanning. Detective Fanning is a constant topic of the One Heat Minute community. We do love him. And we love his slick back hair. His sort of senior partner, Pete Berg, is the worst cop in the history of a Michael Mann movie. But Fanning rules, man. I love him as Fanning. He's great. He's like a little, he's very like Hispanic feeling style. LA look. He's really good for such an East Coast guy. But yeah, I think that's a good theory, you know. Crimes and cabs.
Go with it, you know.
I mean, look, I've done both movies, so I strongly endorse that casting.
There. Yeah,
it's great. Yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy to just take that as a fact from now on. Just in credit this show.
Another thing I love, like if you're playing Connect the Movies, you have Cruz being a jazz head, and then it goes back to, you have to think about Jerry Maguire with his scene where he's going to sleep with Renee Zellweger and the nanny, the Manny, or the au pair, that was the name that he preferred, gives him a tape of the John Coltrane and Miles Davis or Charlie Mingus, I can't remember what, for him to play. And he starts playing it and it goes disastrous. But, you know, you have Cruise with jazz. And so I love that. That's kind of a link the movies a little bit. Yeah.
Listen, Cruise was mansplaining jazz long before Ryan Gosling was in La La Land. So
there you go.
We can just say.
Invent jazz? Or did he? We don't know. Yeah.
I think people are like, did he? Yeah, I think he did. John Legend's like coming in and playing. He's like, what? No, we're good.
Oh, man.
A great scene. Oh, man, I love Barry Chewbacca Hanley so much. Oh, my God. I love him in that scene as Daniel. It's a brilliant scene. He's unbelievable. Great actor. Mm-hmm. Great actor. He's great in Ali too. He does the triple with Man. Yeah. He does Ali, Collateral, straight into Vice, and I think he's unbelievable in all of them. He's my personal favorite in Vice, but yeah, he's so good. I love that scene. It's the movie plays like a bit of a, you know, it's kind of like interconnected stories that, while they're really deeply connected, have beautiful feels. Because that's one of the more extended sequences where you're actually with Max and Vincent on a hit, other than the chaotic nightclub scene. It's such a great little digression in the movie. It changes the pace nicely.
It really does. And then you have people like Javier Bardem in small roles showing up. And Ava DuVernay. I've heard it said both ways, and I'm like, I don't know. Ava DuVernay worked on the film.
I could be wrong. I could be wrong too.
Ava worked on the movie, and she remembers watching that scene play out with Javier Bardem. And this was the film, Collateral, that inspired her to take the plunge from PR. Like, I'm going to do it. I keep talking about making a movie. I want to make a movie. And helped kind of inspire her and get her on her career. And I think this movie inspired a lot of people. There were a lot of people kind of.
Well, the Coens took Javier straight out of this for No Country. It was his first single language film. His first single language film before No Country. Maybe there's one in between, but was his first English language film was Collateral. And then not too long later, he's a gigantic, star and.
Yeah.
Academy Award winner for No Country.
Yes, absolutely. And I think doing this movie digitally, people kind of rag on it for that, but it's a film that showed people what you could do with digital storytelling and digital filmmaking and still have the visual sweep and great music. My God, that's another Michael Mann thing.
Great music. I would just say to folks, if there's one like cross promo I can do, there's a terrific episode that we do with Elliot Koretz, who is the sound designer, like sound editor on both Miami Vice and Collateral. A fantastic guy. And Katie and I have gotten to know Elliot a little bit, and Joseph Tsai, who is one of his main offsiders, particularly on Vice. And he just talks about, like, cinematically, I think your audience will love this, is like, digital photography drastically increases the depth of field. So what you can see in the frame and specific elements pop, you know, like on 35mm film, unless you're using split diopter, you know, like De Palma or Pakula or Steven Soderbergh, for example, like you're not getting things in extreme focus or detailed focus all throughout the level of the frame. And what Elliot said was when they were filming Collateral, and what they started to learn was the digital photography made things clearer through the entire depth of field. So the whole depth of the image that you're seeing, and what that meant for sound design is that you actually had to change the sound design of the movie because there were more things you had to address in the frame in every shot. So like you might see a car moving out, you might see, you know, you might see some kind of like roadside food apparatus. Yeah. You might see, you know, really clearly see a petrol station. You might really clearly see, you know, something in the street, bodies moving, a nightclub in the background. And you have to layer the sound over this now newly multi-layered image that has these things that you have to address. Whereas if you can't see it, you don't have to address it. You can just have what's there. So it's actually really fascinating to see him using digital photography, but expanding the art form, like the holistic immersive experience of what you're viewing at the same time. So when Katie and I spoke to Elliot, we were both kind of like, wow, like that's a huge push in the art form because of just the technical aspect of it. And now everyone is so sort of slavishly trying to turn any kind of digital photography to mimic 35mm film or whatever the case may be. Happened with, you know, 2004 to 2007. Like you look at Zodiac it looks like a movie that was discovered in the 70s in Paramount archives. Whereas this is saying, no, I'm a firmly 2004 artifact and we're changing the way that people interact and are immersed by this art. So that's Michael Mann just being awesome. in my opinion.
For sure. And building out the soundscape to match all of the different elements that you see in a frame that you normally wouldn't. That is really cool. And I 100%. Know that you work with Imprint. We recently collaborated on the same project along with Maria Lewis, Jim Hemphill, yeah. And of course, Travis Woods on the After Dark Neo-Noir Cinema, the third edition box set.
Yes.
What is coming up from Imprint? Anything exciting?
There's so many cool things. I know some things. I don't know if I'm allowed to announce some of them, but I'm going to be cheeky and say a stone cold classic movie is getting the 4K treatment from Imprint.
Cool.
And it is, I don't know if I can say what it is, but I'll just say it's produced by one of my favorite filmmakers. I have done a minute by minute examination of one of his films, part of a trilogy, but it was an Academy Award winning picture that he produced. And I've written an essay for that box set, which is to come. And I don't know if I'm allowed to announce it, which is why I'm tactfully dancing around actually saying what it is. But no, there's amazing stuff. I've recently just got my hands on the Capricorn One box set and a couple of others in the latest batch. There's so much more to come from Imprint. It's actually stupid. And Travis and I are both currently working on pieces for another Imprint set, which I'm not allowed to announce yet. That'll be happening a little bit later in the year. Both subjects close to our heart. So really exciting there. But yeah, Imprint's an amazing boutique Blu-ray label from Oz who are getting bigger and bigger. They recently had like an incredible quartet of some of the best, new 4Ks. I want to shout them all out because it's an amazing set. So the November bundle, which is absolutely incredible, has 4K 40th anniversary limited edition of Neverending Story, Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, 4K, 4K of A Bridge Too Far, and then a 4K of Convoy. It's a pretty incredible batch of films that are coming in November, and it's their first all 4K batch, which is crazy. So really, really cool stuff happening at Imprint.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so much, Blake. I really appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing what's next from you.
Oh, thank you, Jen. Thank you so much. And yeah, it's always great to see you, my friend. And I can't give you a cuddle. That's devastating. I can't be sitting right next to you to just grab you and say,
I know,
hello.
Put on another suit, fly out.
I can put on a suit, but I cannot afford right this second.
I know.
For another international trip. For many reasons, but yes. No, I will make it happen another time soon, hopefully.
Yeah. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.